You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
This is episode 10 of Stable Riding with Solange. This is Solange Ellis, founder of Stable Riding, for the May 26th, 2026, episode 10 of Stable Riding with Solange, part of Horses in the Morning. I'm here the fourth Tuesday of every month to talk to you all about the rider and how we can make ourselves better in the saddle. This month's pod is about all things equisizer. For anyone who's listening who's thinking, what the heck is an equisizer? Here's the lowdown. An equisizer is a riding training tool. It's made of wooden metal. The body is wooden and shaped just like a horse's body. You can ride it bareback, in a pad, or any kind of saddle you'd like to cinch or girth it up with. The base and inner mechanism is metal, and it moves just like a horse. The gait it mirrors the most is the canter, as it was designed to help racehorse jockeys rehab and train. This works great for me in my instruction, as cantering is the gait and motion riders struggle with the most. And therefore, I spend a huge amount of time teaching riders how to canter. I chose to talk about this for the pod this month because I can be quoted over and over again saying, I can only do what I do because I have my equisizers. But for that statement to really make sense, we have to go back in time. Way back to when I first started teaching riders to begin with. I took over a facility and began breaking horses and teaching riders at 15 when I dropped out of school and got my GED. I threw my barn doors wide open and taught riders with no restrictions. I had no age or weight restrictions, no discipline or breed restrictions, no skill or goal restrictions. Anyone who wanted to learn to ride was welcome. My specialty? Real world riding. Fox hunting, trail riding, and hunter paces. Something that no one else in my area was doing, so it created a vacuum, and very quickly my program was full and bursting at the seams. For the better part of the last 26 years of my career, my lesson program was basically full. Now, with the launch of my stable riding system and the creation of my lab, I've shifted more into a specialist role, where riders come to me not just for weekly lessons, but for as-needed checkups and, of course, rider intensives. This model lets me see a much higher volume of riders. So if you ever want a session with me, don't panic. I can probably fit you in better now than I could have 5 or 6 years ago. My program being full for so long meant I teach an incredibly high volume of lessons. Under normal circumstances, I was teaching 35 to 40 lessons a week, each private and 1 hour long, and every type of rider under the sun, beginners to advanced, little kids to riders in their 80s. I was able to create a curriculum that worked well. I had consistent results and happy riders. I could guide riders through the two weight distribution transitions, giving them a true deep seat, followed by a true light seat, and then finally the blended seat type of the high-level riders where you can ride in a deep seat, but with their weight still in their feet. So if I could do all these things, why change? I cracked the code. I knew what to do, when to do, and how to do it. Plus, I had 17 different ways of explaining it, so the instruction landed with each and every individual. Even with all that mastery of my craft and success with my riders, there were two big reasons to change and evolve: time and the Mongol Derby. See, learning to ride takes time, and when you rely on the whims and actions of a live horse, it takes as long as it takes. Let me explain it this way. I have a once-a-week lesson rider who's prepared to do the next big thing in their riding. We've talked about it, worked towards it, with incremental exercises designed to be bridging steps towards their goal. And now it's time to do it. To feel it in their own body and gain confidence, as well as proof of concept that it can indeed be done. Now, for that rider to do that thing, the next big thing, we both need the rider to do something specific. Canter politely and reliably, go over a ground pole, etc. So I, as the instructor, pick the horse most likely to do the thing. I have the horse correctly prepped, the rider prepped, and the tack correct. And then during that lesson, it storms and hails, making a huge noise on the roof. So do we not do the thing that week. That's okay. We'll try again next week. The next week comes along, and that specific school horse, the one that's perfect for that rider to do the thing on, has a shoe off. Try again next week. Week after that, rider comes in late and frazzled from a work kerfluffle. The chi is off and the vibes are bad. So, not that week. Try again. Fourth time's a charm, right? Wrong. The lesson horse spooks at the barn cat and freaks out the rider. So now a full month has gone by without the rider doing the thing because of environmental influences beyond my control. And that list does not include us canceling because it's way hot or too cold out, us canceling because one of us is sick, us canceling because they're not able to make their lesson that week due to a trip, work, or family commitment. So now it could very well be nearly 2 months or longer of Craigslist misconnections that result with that rider still not having done the thing due to no fault of mine, theirs, or the horse. To make it even more unlikely that the rider learns this important thing, even if the stars align and they do get to do it for one lesson, they cannot learn that skill in a single lesson. They need to do it consistently, each lesson, for about 6 to 12 lessons in a row before they begin to feel like they've got it. I need Pony Jesus to smile upon me and have everything work perfectly for weeks in a row to make real progress with that rider. So back in the day, that's what I did. I hoped and prayed and arranged the pieces as best as I could and waited for it to all click. Sometimes it happened immediately. Sometimes it took months. Too much of it was way beyond my control when it came to a rider accessing the hyper-specific body motion necessary to ride the horse. I wanted to compress that timeline and know that I could still have obvious visible results in the rider's motion and body position in fewer sessions. Why? Because as a high-level coach, that's what I wanted. And the riders wanted it too. They wanted to understand, feel, and then consistently do the thing in their body. And ultimately, the sooner that they were moving freely and positioned correctly on the horse's back, the safer they are. So time was a huge driving factor in the creation of my lab and the purchase of my very first Equisizer. This was paired with the Mongol Derby riders who started traveling to me for intensives. I often see them within 6 months of their race and for a discrete period of time. Generally, a 3-day intensive where we work together 6 hours a day. I wanted to furnish these riders with the highest level of instruction possible. They needed hyper-specific skill instruction that will allow them unconscious competence on horseback. So at the race, they can focus on the terrain, navigation, and their riding partners. I wanted them to complete the race without pain and injury and be happy and successful and enjoy this amazing adventure they were going on. And I have exactly 18 hours to do it. No pressure, right? So how do I impart the highest level of skill technique on these derby riders who have often flown into me from a great distance to train? Last year, I had a rider fly to me all the way from Japan. Well, it ended up being a very simple answer. Separate the rider from the emotional and physical complexity of the horse beneath them and give them the time and space to learn what's needed in their own body on a tool that emulates the horse's motion. And that's where the Equisizer comes in. My lab is filled with tools that allow riders to move like they're riding a horse without a horse. But my Equisizer was the first tool I ordered for the space. A student of mine who's a horse racing fanatic has an Equisizer. So I asked her if I could come ride hers to check it out. Big thanks to Chris and Lexington. As soon as I sat on Lexington and I felt the motion for myself, I knew it would work. So I ordered my very first Equisizer from Frankie. I remember him asking me about the mane and what its name would be. I'd not realized that it needed a name. I knew that my next order was going to be the Mighty Bucky, so I figured if I was going to have a Bucky, it made sense to have a Woody. Now with the name and a request for plain short hair like my own, it was just a matter of time until he was built. Frankie's workshop is only a little more than an hour from my farm, so I drove out to pick Woody up. I sometimes look back on that first meeting and wonder what poor Frankie thought as I stood there explaining my system, the lab, and all my grand plans. If he thought I was crazy, he hit it well, and we immediately became friends. With great excitement, I unloaded Woody in the lab and thought to myself, now I have to get riders to use it. And I have to start building out an entire curriculum for it that slots into my existed mounted riding curriculum. So I made a little deal with myself. I'd try and teach at least 2 lessons a week in the lab if I could. I figured that'd be a fairly easy sell to my in-house students and give me the data I needed to curriculum build. Well, I was worried over nothing. Within 3 months, I was teaching 50% of my lessons in the lab. Riders were requesting it. If they had a skill they felt stuck in, they'd asked if I had a lab exercise for it. If they'd been off a few weeks due to schedules or being sick, they'd ask for a lab lesson. If they had a complicated body history and their back or neck or any other joint was bothering them, they'd text me and ask for a lab. I was coming up with exercises daily and realizing the more I did with the Equisizer, that I'd barely scraped the surface of what I could use it for. I remember in the first month of having it, riders try it, they would look at me and say, you need another one of these. They were right. I did need another Equisizer. In fact, I needed many, many more. Since I kept ordering more and more of them from Frankie, I was able to get to know the maker and creator of the Equisizers pretty well. Frankie's a dream to work with and has been a supporter of my stable riding system from the very beginning. Since I talk so much about the lab and its tools here on the pod, I thought Frankie would be just the perfect guest for today's show. And Frankie has been a regular guest on Horses in the Morning since 2010. Frankie, hello. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show today.
Solange, I am more than honored. You know that I'm a big fan of yours, and thank you for having me.
We always have fun together, so I think this is going to be really great. All right. Are you ready? Because I have so many Equisizer-related questions.
Absolutely. I am ready.
Can you tell the audience when you built your first Equisizer, and was it for you or someone else?
That is a great question. So a bit of history. I was a professional jockey for many years. But in my early years, I was only a teenager still, but very active in racing. And I had a crash, basically. Where I had a severely broken leg, and I think I was about 18 years old, and when you as a horse rider, and a lot of people can relate to this, you know, your first concern is when am I going to be able to ride again?
100%.
So I asked the doctor. It's the first thing I asked the surgeon. I said, okay, like how long will this take? When can I get back to racing? And he basically said, well, he says, this is a tricky fracture. And, you know, it's more so if, and that just that, you know, I was floored and scared. And, so I went through a couple of operations and they sent me to rehab, and I stare around the room and I'm thinking, one of the things that came out when I came out of surgery, my knee was completely locked. So his concern was how much motion could I get back in that leg?
Right. Yeah.
So it was really scary. So, you know, you look around the room and the position jockeys ride in, we ride short and very short in the stirrups and we're off the saddle in that 2-point position. And, we need quite a bit of motion in our legs. I just look around the room and it's like, man, there's nothing here. And that I could be simulate sitting on a horse and actually have my foot in the stirrup and actually try to get in that position, that race riding position that we do. So, as a kid, and if I'm long-winded, you can stop me.
But okay.
As a kid, I grew up in the suburbs. So I didn't grow up on a farm. My dad was a jockey. I was obsessed with racing. I was obsessed with the idea of becoming a jockey since I was probably 3 or 4 years old. I already had what we call our tack bag packed. I had 1 boot, 2 pair of goggles, a saddle with that was broken, and I was ready to go by the time I was 4. So I was serious. I was dead serious about what my career path was going to be. So I was saddling instead of a pony like most kids that grew up around horses. I grew up in the suburbs. My dad being a jockey is where the racetracks were built So I was saddling the couch. I was saddling. I was putting boards on buckets
and
anything I could do that I could pretend. And so that's where it actually started. But it wasn't until I had this racing accident. I'm 18 years old and my career is in question. Mm-hmm. So that scared me. And since I'm older now, I'm smarter. I have access to more people rather than when I was like a 10-year-old. I had someone help me. I drew some pictures and I had someone help me build my first horse. And it worked so well, not only for my rehab, but what it did, my fitness level, from the surgeries, I had complete atrophy in my body. It was mm-hmm. my wife looked at me and she cried the first time she saw me get out of bed. Right. I'd gotten down to about 85 pounds. It was such a strange part of my life because I actually fought weight to make weights as a jockey. I was not naturally light. So I built my first horse. And not only was I getting motion and flexion back into my knee and leg, the atrophy started it just started disappearing and I started putting mm-hmm. my muscle right back on where it was. And then the thing I didn't expect was that my form, my position, my style, what we call in racing our style, which mm-hmm. is basically our rhythm and motion as one with the horse, was like I just came off a year from winning the Eclipse Award as leading apprentice in America, so North America. So I was not a slouch. I already had quite a advanced and improved type riding style, but it got even better for my wooden horse. I'm still on crutches. I started using my wooden horse while I'm still on crutches. The atrophy started disappearing. The muscle started coming back. The fitness started coming back, and my form, my riding style was starting to improve.
Yeah.
So months go by, and I check in with my doctor, and he's like, "You look great. You know, what are you doing?" And I didn't really tell him too much. I didn't want him to rain on my parade, so to say.
Exactly.
If I was doing too much. But my last visit, when he gave me the okay to start getting on horses, he was just like, I can't believe how you've bounced back, how you've returned to like this incredible shape. What have you been doing? And I said, well, I've been riding my wooden horse. And he was just amazed by that. Anyway, he gave me the okay. And generally when a jockey gets the okay to ride a horse, a real horse, and they go out to ride a thoroughbred, you better be prepared.
Right.
They're not just riding horses. These horses are bound to do something.
Yeah, you're not getting on a lesson horse. You're not getting on a schoolmaster. You're getting on a race horse.
They're going to take you for a ride. And if you're not ready for it, you're going to hurt yourself. So I had the confidence. I had the fitness that I was ready to jump on a racehorse, which I did. From the doctor's appointment that afternoon, I was at the barn. I was at Belmont Park in the barn. The next morning, I got on 6 head of horses. Mm-hmm. I did workouts. I did everything that you're not supposed to do on day one. I did it. And the trainer, his name was John Campo. He's actually was quite well known in horse racing. Trained Pleasant Colony that won the Derby that year. He said Lovato, are you ready? Can I put you on a horse? This was like a Wednesday. Can I put you on a horse Friday?
Wow.
So I'm going to put you on a winner. And I was like, well, I don't know if you have to bleep me, but I was like, hell yeah. And so he did. He named me on a horse. It was a Wednesday. This is a Friday. This is unheard of in horse racing. It usually takes jockeys 2 or 3 weeks to get to the fitness level.
Oh, I'm sure.
And,
yeah.
To be able to ride a race. And so he did. He put me on a horse, and we won by a nose.
Wow.
By a nostril. So it was a really cool story. But the jocks room, my fellow riders were like, how did you do this? And and I was like, I didn't want to. This is my little wooden horse. And some of my closer friends were like, I got to see this thing. And it was hideous. I mean, it was not, it's not like the Equisizer now. And he was.
Well, it didn't have to be pretty. It just had to work.
It was functional. It was quite goofy looking. But it got the job done. So I returned to racing. I resumed my career. Everything's honky-dory. I got the flexion back in my knee. I did have a second surgery to remove some of the hardware that was in my leg. But I was back on my way. And the wooden horse was in my basement. And, you know, every once in a while I'd have friends over and we would play around and have some fun with it. But it did its job. And then, you know, God willing, I don't have another major injury like that where I'd need it again. It was just it was an ornament, so, and a fun toy. But other jockeys were already starting to bug me to make them one.
Right.
And and I didn't want to do it. It's one, as I was back full force into my racing career, which requires all your time and energy. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't have the time or the tools and that I thought I needed. And I wanted to upgrade it, of course, from, okay, I built this one. If I'm going to do it again, I want to build something nicer. So I put it off for years, and literally about 6 years went by that I finally caved in, and I built a couple of friends a horse. And at that time, it wasn't called the Equisizer; we just called it Frankie's Wooden Horse. So
right,
yeah, and then it just turned into one after another. People like. There was a party out in California, out in Los Angeles, at Lafitte Pinkai's house. And at the time, he was one of the world famous leading jockeys in the entire planet. And he was begging me to make him one. And I told him I would make him one, but please don't tell anybody. I'm trying to keep it low key. I don't want to get this out there. I'm not ready for this. I don't have anybody else that could build them for me at the time. So he ended up having a party where all the jockeys were there from Santa Anita, mm-hmm. all the mm-hmm. Hall of Famers. Mm-hmm. And my phone starts ringing off the hook and they all want me to build them a horse.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my late wife, Sandy, I'm just looking at her. I'm like, oh, this is a can of worms. What do we do?
Yes. And,
so it's getting out there now. And so I built a few more, and then I thought, I better do this properly, and applied for a patent.
Right.
We went to an attorney, and we formed a business that would be separate from my private, my racing business. And so that's where we decided, well, what are we going to name this business? And we decided to name it Wooden Horse Corporation. which I thought was appropriate.
Yeah.
And it still is. We are still the Wooden Horse Corporation. And then we're like, well, what do we want to call this thing? And it was the first thought came in my mind, you know, because you're thinking it's for exercise and mm-hmm. it's based, you know, it's equestrian based. So Equisizer. And ta-da, the Equisizer and Wooden Horse Corporation were officially born.
What an incredible story.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a bit long-winded with it, but that's to get there.
I keep thinking as you're talking, it really comes back to necessity is the mother of inspiration. You know?
Yeah.
And you created something that you needed, that you used to incredible success and benefit in your own life. So therefore, you know the product works because you use it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, there was no doubt. There was no doubt.
It's
and there was no doubt
that
there was
it works so well.
Yeah. And still to this day, there's a void. There's a void that does not bridge the rider from the ground to the horse.
100%.
And
a lot of riders try and use groundwork. They're like, well, my horse will listen to me really well on the ground. And I'm like, yeah, I'm watching you play all of 7 Pirelli's games. He's yo-yoing really well, but can you sit your canter? You know?
Yeah.
And that's where that gap is.
It certainly helps, and even the Pirellis have used the Equisizer for some of their things. You know, everything helps, right?
Yeah,
everything helps. Nothing's you know, but the Equisizer has been a little bit more than some of that stuff that is not the horse. It's not wrapping your legs around the barrel and not moving your hips or your body in position. So
now, how many Equisizers have you built? Today,
that That's a very, you know why that's a very good question, Solange? Because I just built my 1,900th horse.
No way. You were like totally almost at 2K. You got to get like a cake and have a party when you get to 2,000.
My own little party.
Yeah. Can you imagine if you saw them all lined up? That's a lot of equisizers.
You know what? I did that one time. I did the math of what the measurement would be, like nose to tail, how far that would go. And I think it was about 9 miles, something like that.
I once started thinking about how many hours I'd sat on my mounting block in my arena and taught people to ride. And then I started getting close to the number and then I got really upset and I stopped thinking about it. I'm like, you know what? Well, I don't think I actually need to know that number. I think it can just sound nebulous. Now, I remember you telling me that they've been in TV and in movies and used in Hollywood in the past, right? Can you tell us a little bit about their like TV and movie career?
Yes, sure. Again, because there's a void. Now the special effects are getting, they're doing some things, but I can't imagine what they cost. But as far as the equisizer, the most notable movie was the movie Seabiscuit,
right?
Where actor Tobey Maguire, he did not know, he wasn't a rider. And he certainly wasn't a jockey, but coached by Hall of Famer Chris McCarron, who's a big fan of the Equisizer. Mm-hmm. They contacted me, the studio, they wanted to order 6, for example. So long story short, I was able to provide them with a couple, and then we searched around the area of Los Angeles and upstate New York for equisizers that they could get their hands on or rent.
Yeah. How cool.
But long story short, they had 2 of them that they took your equisizers have wheels on them. Well, mm-hmm. they mounted these on camera, tracks, and they had 2 side by side. They mounted mm-hmm. those camera tracks on the back of a flatbed. Mm-hmm. And then special effects dressed up the neck and head to look like real horses. Mm-hmm. Seabiscuit being one of them, War Admiral being the other. And so they were able to film all the close-up scenes with Tobey Maguire or the other actors, and in some case, professional jockeys, Chris McCarron being one of them. All the close-up scenes, and they could make these equisizers on these tracks move side to side and forward and back.
And this so that's all how happened because 18-year-old Frankie broke his leg.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like that's the butterfly effect. That's, I mean, wow. When you think about it, it's really incredible, Frankie.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I was very proud of that, being a part of the Seabiscuit movie. Another recent one was a movie called Ride Like a Girl that was filmed in Australia, a true story, with female jockey Michelle Payne that won the Melbourne Cup. And when it was coming out, I didn't know anything about it. And mm-hmm. my daughter actually said they were watching a preview for a movie, and I saw an equisizer in the background, and I had to go through my records, and I saw that I made Michelle Payne and her family an equisizer there in Australia back in 1999. to find
that
out.
That leads into my next question. You sell them all over the world, like globally. There are equisizers everywhere, right?
Yes, yes. To date, I've counted about 35 countries, different countries over the world. It was like the equisizer is just now being known in the equestrian world, the open equestrian world, but in horse racing, it's quite the staple. Even the word equisizer, if somebody puts a saddle on a bale of hay, they'll call it an equisizer. And it's really cool because it's all over the world. Australia, of course, was very popular in horse racing. But we've reached, all parts of Europe, the Middle East, Asia, South Africa, every continent has an equisizer, which is pretty cool.
Wow.
And now it's starting to reach standard equestrians. So English and Western riders, in parts of Europe and Australia and South Africa, and even therapy centers and equine assisted centers all over the world are purchasing my equisizer. I just sent one to Germany and one to France to two experts that do hippotherapy and that are adaptive riding experts.
Well, you're totally ahead of me, Frankie, because one of my questions was, I came to understand by being in your Facebook groups how much the equisizers are part of, like you said, hippotherapy and therapeutic riding and, you know, therapy centers for riders and kids. And it makes complete sense that it affords them the motion, but slightly less of the danger, right? And my question for you is, did you envision that you would be selling them to therapy facilities when you started? And maybe yes, because you did it for your own rehab, but then for a long time, it was inside the racing industry. Like, did the fact that the equine therapy organizations adopted it and used it so thoroughly, did that come as a surprise to you? Did you market to them, or did it just sort of happen on its own?
It just sort of happened. And I'd like to tell, I'll tell a cute little story. It's actually a very powerful story, but when I first developed, this was back in the late 80s, I was just selling to jockeys, and I had a friend's wife that was a volunteer at a therapeutic riding program. So back then, therapeutic riding programs weren't as popular as they are now, because mm-hmm. the benefits just keep growing, and people are more mm-hmm. recognizing the benefits of using horses for therapeutic purposes. But anyway, this wife of a racing horse trainer came to me and said, "Frankie, we have a program out in Long Island." We were in New York at the time, out in Long Island. That there's a small boy. I think he was about 10 years old. He's involved with the program. He's got cerebral palsy. He's in a wheelchair. He's restricted to a wheelchair. We know the horses will help him. He loves horses. He loves coming out to the barn, but he's horrified to get on a horse. And would you bring one of your equisizers out to the barn? And we just want to see how what it'll be like for him to get out of his wheelchair. One of his biggest fears, and for a lot of people with CP, they're very constricted. Their muscles are in knots, right?
Right.
So that's part of the anxiety. And then you have the horse, and then you have the height of the horse.
Yeah.
So you have several different levels of issues that you have to kind of you tackle, right? So they asked me to bring an equisizer out. I brought an equisizer out, and we wheel the thing out. They bring his wheelchair over, and they carefully place him on the equisizer. Now, it's a very slow process. You kind of have to know what you're doing. And again, their muscles are in knots, so his legs are cramped up, his mm-hmm. hands and arms are cramped up. And they put him on the equisizer, and they just gently start making it move. He starts to, like a flower, like blossom. Like his legs start to relax. He starts to be able to sit up straight. He becomes more verbal, being able to say his words clearer. And they were all like looking at this and like in tears. So that's when, and my wife and I, my late wife, Sandy, and I were like, oh my goodness,
right.
this was such a powerful moment.
Yeah.
And then that's not the end of it. And then he's pointing at the horse, the real horse, and he wants to ride.
Mm-hmm.
It was the bridge. It changed
exactly.
Everything. And so that's when I was like, oh my goodness, you know, and then I'm thinking, is it enough? Is the equisizer enough? Do I need to do this? Do I need to do that? What can make it better? And I'm still doing that for, you know, 35 years later.
Well, that's how creative minds work, you know.
but you know what? I had an email just last week, Solange, with a program that just got their equisizer, and I got the same letter, the same results. They had two riders that one had severe anxiety issues that wanted to ride. Lost 100 pounds so that would be able to ride, and
yes.
had a anxiety attack, But when I got the equisizer, he rode the equisizer and he was like, I can do it. And they put him on a horse. And then I had another young girl that was that also had a lot of anxiety. And she rode the equisizer and she was ready for the horse. So it was, they were said, in one day, they changed two people's lives. And I was like, okay, I'm on the right track.
You are. Well, and you hit on the like really the perfect design the first time. And then that makes you think, well, surely I didn't get it right the first time. Obviously I need to, do you know what I mean? But you just got it right the first time.
I got a funny story to that. If I'm not, again, I feel like I'm long winded, but yes,
I'll cut you off if I have to, but tell us another story.
So this is like 30 years ago. This is how long I've been doing it, Solange. This is about 30 years ago. I decide, okay, you know, I know the equisizer is great for racing. I know it's great for these therapeutic riding programs, but what about, you know, equestrians? They're going to want and need more. And, so I had some drawings, some designs, and some really rough prototypes of ideas of what I thought to bring more simulation to movement. So walk, trot, canter, really want to get that 2-beat trot down. And, I think that that's going to be the key to success. And so I went to a mechanical engineering firm. I did some research and I brought them all this information, my drawings, some prototypes, and I dropped it off, and there's a team of mechanical engineers. Mm-hmm. And what I learned, you know, after going through thousands of dollars and weeks, yes, of time,
yes,
they're like, we don't know how you did this.
Right.
We can't
improve upon it.
We can't figure this out.
Yep.
Yeah. The only way they could improve on it, and it would have to be test and trial and error, is actually putting motors in it, putting either adding some sort of a gear system, motors.
Yeah, but I think it would lose something, because the fact that it's rider powered has more relevance to the people's body motion.
This I've learned, and it's still a message that doesn't reach the equestrian world, but I've learned the organic experience is it beneficial, which is knowing what your body, what your muscles, mm-hmm, what your position, mm-hmm, your rhythm. You know, the equisizer, a great horseman, Steve Lanfitt, and Terry Myers, two great horsemen, they both just said, this thing's like a lie detector, tells on you.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. That's what you need.
And I love that, because it is such an organic experience. It's if it's not moving right, you're the one that's not moving it right.
Right.
And
that's just the key. That's what the riders need.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, long story short, I spent thousands of dollars with experts, mechanical
to learn that you were right.
To learn that.
But at least you didn't learn that you were wrong, right? Like, at least they're like, this is amazing, you know?
It's well, thank you. It's been a never ending journey, but I haven't changed. I have not changed this system since 1993. So that's 33. Am I doing my math right? 33 years ago.
Decades of proven results. That's a lot of data.
That I cannot. You know, I've still, you know, kicked the tires here and there. Like, let me try this, and it just doesn't. It doesn't work. It only works the way it. And you're right, Solange. I did it on the first try, and I don't know how I did it. It's all pivot points and position.
A download from the universe. My one friend would say you received a download from the universe. If the listeners want to know more about Equisizer, and of course, we'll link all this in the show notes and everything, where can they go to find you, Frankie, and learn more and see if they want to get one for themselves?
Well, if anybody, I'd like to mention my Facebook groups. And
yes.
Because I think they're just a great resource, and it's not me. It is me. I share things, but it's people,
but
like
you're hearing
you
from people who
things.
Have them. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And, I want to start with my Facebook groups, which is Equisizer Therapy, which is based for, it's directed towards the professionals and private homes that use the Equisizer for therapeutic purposes. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Equisizer Adventures, which is, It's mostly middle-aged women that are had their kids and want to get back to riding, or they had to have a hip replacement or a knee replacement, or they got an equisizer and they just want to share the love. And so Equisizer Therapy and Equisizer Adventures are the Facebook groups. And then we have our web addresses. And you'll laugh because Equisizer is a little challenging to spell. It can be spelled several different ways. So I have the domain names of all the misspellings.
Oh, my God.
So Equisizer.
That's thinking like a businessman, Frankie. That's the key to success, that kind of thinking.
So it goes even deeper than that. You'll laugh even further. So Equisizer, the proper name spelling is EQUISIZER. Now, if you misspell it, there's like I don't want to even misspell it. I probably can't. My brain probably won't do it. But it might still bring you to the website because I have Equisizer spelled with an S and spelled with a Z in the middle and a C
That's
at the end.
So amazing.
But then this is the funny part. I gave up on those and frankieshorse.com brings you to my website. frankieshorse.com. So
there's a lot of ways, dear listener, that you can get in touch with Frankie.
If you give up trying to spell Equisizer, an autocorrect is another thing. I mean, it's just frankieshorse.com gets you there.
That's
exercisehorse.com gets you there. So
that's
I covered
hoot,
all my bases.
That's good SEO, right? All right, Frankie, last but not least, what's next for Equisizer?
Okay. So I am still this little small business that makes these horses by hand.
Frankie makes them by hand.
We've reached every continent and about 35 countries. I'm 63 years old now, Solange.
You would know. 5 foot tall. You could take 10 years off. You could take 10 years off, I swear.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm only 5 foot tall, and I'm handling these horses that are twice my weight. So, building these things is I'm working on a way that I'm going to try to develop an Equisizer that I do not have to physically build myself and could be more accessible. That's a project I'm working on. I don't have enough information to say when this is going to launch, but I'm hoping
we don't have a formal launch. Yeah.
Right,
but the balls are in motion.
The balls are in motion, and the Equisizer, it deserves, it's bigger than me. It is my point.
Yeah.
And I've never been able to find someone to help me build these, like all the different various stages, or could I afford to hire a crew that had these skills that go into this? So that's the tricky part. That's why it's stayed the way it's been for all these years, it just being a small mom and pop shop business. But I'm going to try to change that, and it deserves that chance. This business, this product, this concept, it deserves a chance to really get out there in the world and offer it to a much bigger audience than
what
I can
provide.
Well,
I think the demand is there. You know, you've never been sitting around twiddling your thumbs, Frankie.
Yeah, true.
Like,
I mean,
the consumer base exists for more of them.
I believe that now more than ever, and I feel responsible to make that happen. If anything, I'm slowing it down at this point. So,
well, I can't wait because I need at least two more.
You can have your own derby.
yes, exactly. But I'm excited for the future of Equisizer, Frankie, and I can't wait to see what you come up with next, because I think it's going to be really transformative to the horse business at large.
Well, your support has been so important with the growth and the process of where I'm going. So I really want to thank you for that, Solange. You've been very influential on me.
Well, what happens, listeners, every couple of months I call Frankie and I'm like, what are you doing? What are we doing? What's happening? And I go, if I'm ever too annoying, just don't answer and text me and go, I can't talk to you right now.
That'll never happen.
I know. You're very sweet, Frankie. You always take my call.
Yes. Yes. I'm tripping over lumber trying to get to the phone to answer your
call. Well, Frankie, thank you so much for being on the podcast and sharing some really, just incredible stories about the Equisizer. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity. I really do appreciate it. And I hope your listeners enjoy it. So
I think so. Thank you, Frankie.
Okay. Thank you, Solange.
As a small business owner, I really appreciate Frankie. He invented an amazing product, produces and sells them all over the world, and is funny, smart, and easy to work with. Plus, a fabulous podcast guest to boot. My herd of Equisizers, I currently have 5, my dream is 7, are really the backbone of my lab and my program. They would let me do what I do at events like Equine Affair, where I can teach riding in the middle of an expo space. When a new rider comes to my program for the first time, that lesson now is always on an Equisizer in the lab. As this is the best place for me to start my diagnostic process and take a rider bio. And now it's really why people come to me. They often have horses at home. If they want to ride a horse, they can. What they want and need is the lab and its tools in concert with my instruction. For my final thoughts on the Equisizer, before I move on to posting, I want to talk about memory slots. I grew up playing old school video games, which were cartridges that you put in a machine. These games had memory slots or save slots, and the standard amount was 3. You had 3 saved games. This is how I think about the human brain. We can hold 3 thoughts simultaneously, and when we add a 4th thing, our brain has to drop and forget one of the previous 3. This has nothing to do with how old you are or how smart you think you are or how smart you don't think you are. This is just how the human brain works. When you're riding a horse, 2 of your 3 brain slots are thinking about the large flight animal that you've strapped yourself to, which leaves 1 sad, lonely brain slot to think about your chin, your shoulders, your hands, your heels, your legs, your hips, your stirrups, and your body motion. And that's just not enough. This is why riders will ride and ride and feel like they never really get any better, because they're not. They're chasing their tail around and around, trying to think about a million things, all while controlling a horse. The Equisizer gives the rider the other 2 brain slots back. Suddenly, they have the ability to think and move exclusively about their body and therefore learn the movement they need and then apply it back into the saddle on a live horse. And I'll tell you what, you guys, it works every time. Okay, posting time. Here's how we are going to start talking about posting. We're going to talk about body motion. We're going to talk about body position and rhythm. So to start, there are 2 ways to place your legs when you sit on a horse. Femurs or thighs rotated in, where you grip with your thighs and knees and your toes point straight. The other is femurs or thighs naturally opened, where your knees do not grip or pinch. Instead, you track the horse with the back of your thigh bones and calf, and this position allows your toes to turn out at a 45-degree angle and your heels to go down. Currently, in today's culture of high-level dressage supremacy, riders who are not professional or high-level dressage riders are being asked to post in shoulder hip heel alignment with their toes turned straight, which is very difficult. In fact, it's exactly how you post bareback. So unless you come to me and you're like, oh yeah, I can totally post bareback, that posting technique is probably not the best match for you. Also, that posting technique is designed for short bursts of posting, maybe 30 to 60 strides, not laps and laps around the arena or longer distances like on a trail ride or a fox hunt. If that whole thing still does not make sense to you, feel free to shoot me an email at Solange@stableriding.us, and I can expand on that further. But since I teach very few professional dressage riders or riders who ride exclusively bareback, I'm going to assume that my listener base is approximately the same and talk today about normal, regular posting, not the adaptation to posting that dressage and bareback riders have to make. Our horse trots up and down while moving forward, so we need to rise up and down to post, not forward and back. The forward and back sort of posting that some riders have been taught is less stable for the rider. It requires less physical effort, but is definitely less stable. I call this motion pendulum posting, as the rider swings up and forward and then down and back and looks from the side like the pendulum at the bottom of a grandfather clock. Instead, we need to post up and down like a piston in a tube, which is how the horse moves. Up and down, not back and forth. So that's the motion part of posting. Next is the rhythm part. Many riders are told, let the horse push you up, wait for the horse to move you. This is really bad advice. Practicing letting the horse throw me up and forward out of the saddle sounds a lot like I'm practicing letting my horse throw me up and out of the saddle, which sounds like a guaranteed future fall and how you end up talking to the nice doctors in the emergency room. Instead, think about your posting motion being a fraction of a second ahead of your horse. Your posting motion sets the speed and impulsion for your horse's trot. They follow you, not the other way around. I tell my riders to imagine those big old ancient rowing ships. They all had a man on them with a drum who hit the drum to tell the men in the boat when to row. That's your job when you post. Your posting motion is the metronome to your horse's gait. So we've covered the motion and the rhythm. Next up, body position. Posting is a light seat position, which means your weight is in your feet and in your stirrups the whole time. Your stirrups are the floor you're standing up off of. To find your light seat, keep your ribs lifted and lean forward from your waist the amount that takes your weight from your seat bones and puts them into your stirrups. In this light seat position, your thighs are rotated out the amount that puts your calf on, not your knee, and turns your toe out at a 45 degree angle. The reason you choose to post with this leg position is because when you are posting, your knee and thigh are moving, so you cannot grip with them or have stable contact with the horse with your knees and thighs because they're moving. When you're posting, the only part of your leg that is still unstable touching the horse's side is your calf. And you can only put your calf on by rotating your leg out at that 45 degree angle. Also, when your feet are under you, you're accessing your stirrups again as the floor to rise up off of. And that external rotation of your leg is the only way that your leg bones will allow you to put your heels down when your foot is under you. And heels lower than toes is a requirement for posting. Anyone who tells you otherwise is selling something. For my Princess Bride fans out there, I'm certain the Dread Pirate Roberts had his toes out and his heels down when he posted his trot. If your foot is flat or your heels come above your toes when posting, you will feel like you're going to fall forward in the up portion of the up part of your post, and then you'll feel like you're falling back down and landing harder than you'd like in the downbeat. When you're posting correctly, your upper body is just chilling, but your lower body and legs are engaged and working the entire time. Posting is just squats in stirrups. You rotate your toes out, put your heels down, and push down against your stirrup to drop your heel, and then unbend your knee to lift your hips and torso up. You then control your downbeat back into the saddle with the muscles of your legs, keeping that same upper body inclination. You're touching down not on your seat bones, but on the flat part of your thigh just below your butt. You do not sit, relax, or sink into the saddle on your downbeat. You just touch the saddle with your body and then rise up again, keeping all of your weight in your stirrups. Now, does this sound tricky? Yeah, because in the beginning, it is. Posting is a highly technical physical motion. But once you learn it, it's very economical, as the horse is providing you with the up, and your job is just to control the down. Posting is so often overlooked. People will say, all I'm doing is posting my trot, like it's no big deal. But the posting trot is the gateway position into cantering, galloping, and jumping. If you have a position fault or a weight distribution inadequacy in your posting, you take that right into cantering, galloping, and jumping. So the best place to build a stable position at those faster gates and over fences is when you're posting. Never underestimate the importance of a correct posting position and motion. Can you guess your homework, dear listener? You got it. Posting your walk. Posting the walk is the only exercise that never becomes redundant, no matter how long you've been riding. I tell my Mongol Derby riders when they're only a few weeks out from their race, who want to keep training but don't want to injure or strain themselves, that they should post the walk, which is usually met with a heavy sigh and a roll of the eyes, but they're pretty serious about their training and they do it anyway. The reason that posting walk is so handy is that you can do it as slow as you want or as fast as you want. Since all the horse has to do is sort of amble along, you can take your time and think just about your heels or your calves or your shoulders. You can pause in your upbeat and look down at your foot, or close your eyes and feel if your weight is evenly distributed between your two stirrups. You'll really never improve or evolve your posting skills while trotting because the horse is taking up two of your brain slots. All the improvement is made posting the walk, and then we apply it back into the trot. So here are your posting walk instructions. With your chin and ribs lifted, incline forward from your waist the amount that puts your weight fully in your stirrups. Keeping your toes out at that 45 degree angle, push off your stirrup into your heel to unbend your knee and raise your hips up over your feet. You should be able to pause and hold that upbeat for a few strides, concentrating on toes out, heels down, without wobbling and falling either forward onto their neck or back in the saddle. Then slowly and with control, lower yourself down to touch the saddle by closing and bending your knee joint. This is difficult. It's supposed to be. So if you do it and think, man, that's hard, that's okay. I recommend, as always, you try posting your walk for about 10 minutes over the course of your overall ride. If you do this consistently, you will find that after posting walk, posting your trot feels like a vacation. As always, any questions? Let me know. That's what I'm here for. You can find our show notes and links to today's guests and products in the show notes on your podcast player or on the website at stableriding.us. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok as Stable Riding. We're here once a month on the fourth Tuesday of every month. We have our own open RSS feed. Just search Stable Riding with Solange in your podcast player, or you can find us on the main Horses in the Morning feed. All riders can be stable riders, and a stable rider makes for a happy horse.